Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Robert Palmer. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Ambrose, and I'm representing him in conjunction with the University of Notre Dame Law School. This case, when it was assigned to me by the court, reminded me of my high school days when I used to watch my classmates at a track meet, the people running the high hurdles. There are many hurdles you have to go over to get to that finish line on the merits of the case. And you can trip on any of those hurdles and fall flat on your face. And I have several procedural hurdles in this case. The first one was raised in the Certificate of Appealability, where we had to discuss whether there was a right to appellate counsel under the Illinois Sexually Dangerous Persons Act. As a subset of that, I would have to argue whether or not, assuming there was a right to appellate counsel, whether or not it was ineffective and possibly cause for to excuse procedural default. The government in this case also filed a motion to vacate this court's certificate of appealability, saying that the allegations in the petition for habeas relief did not raise a fundamental due process claim, raised only a confrontation clause claim, and therefore the court improvidently granted the certificate of appealability, and the case should be dismissed. So with all those hurdles to go through, I'll start with the certificate of appealability. I can see that the petition for habeas relief does not raise, in so many words, the words due process or equal protection. It raises a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses when the witnesses testified as to prior wrongdoing of Mr. Ambrose, prior alleged crimes, without convictions or even arrest for those crimes. I think it's apparent from this court's grant of the certificate of appealability that the words of the petition for habeas relief do bring to mind the fundamental due process rights.
No, first the court didn't issue a certificate of appealability. One judge did. We can reexamine that. But second and more important, as I'm sure you know, we issue certificates of appealability based on claims made in this court without examining the whole record. The nature of the argument the state is making here is basically that we issued a certificate of appealability based on representations that were made to us about what issues were presented, and the state is contending that those issues, although they may have been presented to us, haven't been preserved. That was just not examined. Institutionally, we don't examine arguments like that before issuing a certificate. But they've been made now, so we have to reach them.
Correct, Your Honor. And the claims were made in the petition for habeas relief, wherein Mr. Ambrose, pro se, alleged that there was evidence of prior wrongdoing that for which he was neither arrested nor convicted, and that he raised it as hearsay, he raised it as confrontation clause. But I think that it is so well settled that evidence of prior wrongdoing, prior alleged crimes without convictions is a fundamental problem.
Well, that would be true if you were being charged with a crime, but he's being charged, not charged, but he's being alleged to be mentally deficient. And almost all doctors rely on matters of hearsay in making diagnoses, don't they?
They do, Your Honor.
Yeah. And isn't that what this is, a diagnostic problem? The doctors say the defendant has psychiatric problems that cause him to become a sexually dangerous person. What used to be called a sexual psychopath.
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you. You've just gotten me over all those hurdles to the end line, finish line, where I have to address the merits of the case.
Look at the time saver I am.
The difference, Your Honor, is this was not the original commitment proceeding in which past history was relevant and necessary to determine whether or not Mr. Ambrose was a sexually dangerous person.
The allegation raised by your client, I gather, is he's no longer suffering from this disease.
Correct, Your Honor.
That still requires a diagnostic, psychiatric diagnosis.
It does, Your Honor, but it requires a diagnosis of what happened from the time of the prior diagnosis until the time he filed his petition he had recovered.
I shouldn't think so. I should think that it would cover the entire spectrum of it. He can't just say, starting from here, I am not as bad as I was then, or just consider my behavior from this point on.
I respectfully disagree with you, Your Honor, because this is a recovery proceedings. The issue is whether
he has to know what he recovered from before they can get around to seeing whether he recovered.
The prior order committing him as a sexually dangerous person is what was the baseline from which to determine whether he had recovered. What happened?
The predicate for that finding, however, is also available to the doctors who are diagnosing him now.
It's available, Your Honor, but I don't believe that it's relevant to determine whether he has recovered.
An interesting position.
It's a position that I was forced to take, Your Honor, because there is no other position.
I'm not fighting with you. I'm just saying it's an interesting position.
I was wondering if the time frame here is typical for recovery determinations, because he files a motion in December 2005, and the judge determines he's not recovered in June 2008.
Correct, Your Honor. Those were the dates. Why it took so long to get to the judge in a bench trial, I have no way of knowing. He was actually committed in, I believe it was 1998 or 1999, so there was a 6 or 7 year period from the time he was committed until the time he alleged that he had recovered. The most, in my opinion, the most interesting and probably from the aspect of the law itself issue is whether or not Mr. Ambrose had a right to appellate counsel in his recovery proceedings. A very quick read of Brown v. Waters would seem to indicate that no, he did not, and therefore the case goes away because there's no excuse for procedural default. But in considering Judge Easterbrook's comments about this certificate of appealability, if it was that easy, I'm not sure that the judge who granted the certificate of appealability would have cited Brown v. Waters and said address the issue anyway. So,
what institution is he incarcerated?
It's Big Muddy River.
Oh, yeah.
Or some, it's, as I understand it, it's not a place that is a pleasant place to be.
Sounds horrible.
And this is a person who has not been convicted of a crime. He is not sentenced under the Sexually Violent Persons Act, where the prerequisite is a conviction for a crime. He was committed under the Alternative Sexually Dangerous Person Act. So that is the first distinction I make with respect to the Brown v. Waters case. That case was brought up under the Wisconsin Sexually Violent Persons Act, in which all the procedural and constitutional requirements for a criminal conviction are in place before there is a commitment. That does not necessarily happen in these cases, in which the prosecutor elects to pursue the person under a Sexually Dangerous Person Act. He doesn't have to be convicted of a crime. He just has, there are certain prerequisites about mental illness and tendencies to sexual misconduct, put in the simplest way. So I think that while Brown v. Waters does say in broad terms that there is no right to appellate counsel in civil commitment proceedings, you have to limit it to the facts of that case in which it was a sexually violent person and not a sexually dangerous person and all the fundamental protections that exist.
Almost a distinction without a difference, isn't
it? No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is. The Illinois courts have said throughout discussions of Sexually Dangerous Person Act that the protections need to be higher in those cases because you don't have the protections of a criminal conviction preceding the commitment. Also, under the Sexually Dangerous or Violent Persons Act, the commitment is something in addition to the sentence. The criminals in those cases are sentenced, and then this is something in addition to the sentence. Under the Sexually Dangerous Person Act, there's no conviction. They're just committed. This is a sentence, although the term is not used as sentence. The second thing I think needs to be brought up in distinguishing Brown v. Waters is the fact that the court in that case said Mr. Brown did not raise any constitutional provisions for a right to an appellate counsel. And in this case, we do. We raise the fundamental due process protections of the 14th Amendment as applied by the Supreme Court in Douglas v. California. Opposing counsel criticizes the use of that case, but it exists. It is a Supreme Court case, which this court has to give credence to. And under that case, if there...
Well, at least we have to follow whether we give it credence or not.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct. Under that case...
It's an unbelievable Supreme Court case, but they're there.
And I'm not sure we would agree on which ones were unbelievable, but you're right.
Your rebuttal argument time.
Yes, I understand, Your Honor. But I do think I need to make the point that under Illinois law, people committed under the Sexually Dangerous Person Act and people who are denied release under the recovery are entitled to an appeal of those decisions. Because they are entitled to the appeal, the state cannot discriminate against those who are indigent and not appoint counsel for people who cannot afford the appeal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Ms. Stotts.
May it please the Court, Counsel, Rita Stotts from the Attorney General's Office for the respondent. This claim is waived and defaulted, but the simplest way to resolve it is on the merits, because it is all but foreclosed by Supreme Court precedent.
I'm an older chap. Would you raise your voice, darling?
Of course. The record here makes clear, and petitioner seems to concede in his reply, that this wasn't substantive evidence of propensity. It was basis of opinion evidence under Rule 703 that the doctor based her opinion on sexual dangerousness on. Now, what Williams v. Illinois says is that where you have a bench trial, 703 evidence doesn't even create a confrontation clause problem.
Are the commitments under this to the Department of Mental Health, or are they to a specific institution?
Sexually dangerous persons are to Big Muddy River Correctional Center, which does also house convicts. For the most part, the sexually dangerous persons are kept separate from the convicts. They're not celled together. So what Williams says is that where you have a bench trial, you apply the presumption that the trial court understands the rules of evidence and only relies on evidence for the purpose for which it's properly admitted. So if 703 evidence isn't a problem, a confrontation clause problem in a criminal trial where there's a bench, it's hard to see how it could be a due process problem in a civil case, which is what we have here. Even if it had been admitted as substantive evidence of propensity, which it wasn't, there still wouldn't be a due process problem even if this was a criminal case, because that's the rule that the Supreme Court declined to establish in Estelle versus McGuire. Petitioner says that this propensity evidence is irrelevant, but that's not true. We know from what the Supreme Court said in civil commitment cases like Heller v. Doe.
Does Illinois have parallels to federal rules of evidence 412 to 415?
I believe so. I don't remember what those rules are. For the most part, the rules track.
Allow the admission of propensity evidence in sexual cases. Right? They effectively rescind Rule 404B for cases dealing with sex crimes.
I believe we do. In this case, the evidence wasn't admitted for propensity.
The reason I raise it is because those rules that in federal criminal cases have been challenged as violations of the Constitution, and those challenges have been rejected. The rules, most judges think they're terrible rules, but they also think they are constitutional rules.
Right. So even if it had been propensity, even if this had been a criminal case, still no due process problem. Again, it wasn't propensity evidence. It was 703 evidence. And that is relevant. Prior conduct is a good indicator of future tendencies. And that's the whole issue here. Is petitioner likely to molest more children if he's released? On top of that, there's the problem that to make out a due process claim, a habeas petitioner has to show not only that the outcome might have been different, which is what petitioner's saying, but that there's a substantial probability that the verdict was actually wrong, that he's not sexually dangerous. Petitioner isn't even arguing that. The state court found as a matter of fact that he was, and that finding's controlling under 2254E1. I note, too, that the petitioner has mentioned that this is compared to the criminal context and said it was a sentence. That's just not true. The Supreme Court said as much in Allen versus Illinois. This is a civil case. This is not punishment. As for his point about sexually dangerous persons don't necessarily have a prior conviction, where sexually violent persons do, and that was what was at issue in Brown, to the extent he's suggesting that there's a higher risk of error because of that distinction, that argument doesn't hold up. For one thing, the original sexually dangerous person's trial, the result there is there's no reason to think it's less reliable than a criminal trial. And under Illinois law, the defendants in these cases have the right to trial counsel, to have their own experts, to confront and cross-examine. They have a right to the beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof, which is higher than what the Constitution requires. So there's no reason to think the result in the original trial is less reliable. Not only that, the question of whether the underlying offenses were committed is limited to that original proceeding. The petitioner can challenge it at trial, on direct appeal, or in a collateral attack in state court. But as he himself acknowledges, we're now at the recovery stage. He doesn't get to relitigate whether he committed the underlying offenses. The question here is whether things have changed and whether he's recovered. So there's no suggestion that the risk of error in that type of analysis is so high that he would need appellate counsel as a matter of constitutional law. As for Douglas, it does have sweeping language, but it's definitely been limited to its facts. If it were true, if what Douglas says about the state has to appoint counsel in every case where it allows people with money to hire their own attorneys, then of course, the state would be required to appoint counsel at discretionary appeals, and we know from Ross v. Moffitt that they're not. So Douglas should be limited to its facts and shouldn't be extended here. Unless the court has any questions, I'll ask the court to affirm the judgment.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Palmer?
Yes, sir.
Just a couple of very brief points, Your Honor. With respect to the presumption that the trial judge ignores inadmissible evidence, the Illinois case Beshears, which we cited, which said that this type of evidence is incompetent, was a bench trial, not a jury trial. And despite that, the decision to commit in that case was reversed. And finally, with respect to whether or not this is a sentence, this court acknowledged in the Stachelak case, which we cited, that these niceties of language are not realistic, that in these cases, these people are put away often for life because under the system that exists, it's a warehousing for social misfits.
If you say something like these niceties of language don't matter, aren't you then trying to distinguish Brown against Waters on the ground of niceties of language?
No, Your Honor, because Brown does not have language dealing with this, whereas Stachelak talks about whether or not this is a sentence or really a recovery system. It says that under the system as it exists, recovery is not likely. These people are warehoused because they're social misfits. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, thank you very much. And Mr. Palmer, we appreciate your willingness and that of the law school to accept the appointment and your assistance to the court as well as your client.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. And the